movement in all these parts of the world appears to be much easier compared to the kind of challenges that we face in Africa. It's a very different situation from Africa because it's a very complex economic and political situation that underlie all of this. And because of that, I believe that it's different. We can't just take the approaches and the experience that are occurring in the rest of the world and expect it's going to work. I think that there'll be a lot of failures and then people will begin to realize what's going on. In Africa, well, the first thing you have to ask is, what do I mean by Africa? Some people say Africa is the whole continent. Some people think of Africa as sub-Saharan Africa, which is minus North Africa. That's if you consider North Africa as being more part of Arabia and the Middle East culturally and so on than Africa itself. And you also have South Africa, or the southern part, which due to the existence of the Republic of South Africa is much more advanced than the rest of Africa. So it changes the whole characteristics and makes everything different. Some of the organizations we have, for example, in Africa that promote free software can be thought of in different ways. There's one called FOSFA, which started recently, of which I was one of the founding members, which is called the Free and Open Source Foundation for Africa. Okay. Can you please do it?
No, give me that.
Yeah. FOSFA, that's the Free and Open Source Foundation for Africa. FOSFA, I think, started at one of the WSIS meetings where they were talking about how are we going to promote free and open source software in Africa. And then a group of people decided quickly to come back to Africa and start this sort of foundation to help promote this. At that time, I was in Ghana. I didn't attend that original WSIS meeting, but a friend or colleague of mine who did came, and the first indications were quite worrying. What he said was that, Guido, there's some big money in this free and open source software thing, you know, they're going to release a lot of money. Let's form a Linux users group, you know, we're going to get some money. And I was worried, but unfortunately, you have to contend with factors like that in the African context. So you can see that even the genesis of our organization, which is supposed to do free and open source software, is not really organized around the people who are going to be actually working with it. And I think it reflects in the membership of the FOSFA governance that I saw over time. For example, at the first meeting where we all met in South Africa, I realized that most of these people were actually not running Linux. They were running Windows. I'm running Windows now, but I've been, for the first time in about 4 years, and for a project. I'm doing it for a project. So if this is how this Free and Open Source Foundation has started, is it going to succeed? Is this the right channel to promote? And do they even understand what free and open source software is? And actually, the answer is no, they do not. The governance of the FOSFA body is based on a kind of dictatorship. They do not listen to people. There's no open process for making decisions. And you have debates on the mailing list, and then a decision contrary to what was agreed on the list is suddenly taken, etc. So there's no spirit of openness. There's no freedom within this thing. And obviously, it's going to be hard to work. Not many governments are doing anything to promote the free software thing. But for example, within South Africa, you have the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, the MERACA and stuff, and they're doing a lot to promote free software within South Africa. One of the few real African free software projects, I think, would be the translate.org.za project, which actually is trying to take KDE, Mozilla, OpenOffice, and translate it into the South African languages. I believe they have 12 official languages in South Africa, and they're going to be translating the key pieces of free and open source software into it. But I would like to see a little more activity than that. I view translation as, if you take free software like an onion, it's one of the outer layers. The core is development of new stuff. And apart from that, you also have people working within education. There's a gentleman here called Joris Coman who has done Microsoft a big disservice. He's Microsoft's number one enemy in Africa because one man has managed to push through Linux in such a way that when you do a study on the educational system, it's totally skewed. There's Linux all over the place. And Joris here, it's to thank for that. He's a real champion. Then we have in South Africa, for example, Obsidian, which is one of the few companies operating with free and open source software. Uganda, you have something like Linux Solutions, but these are pure free and open source corporates, have very few and far in between. And then you also have a few individuals here and there, but they're also few and far in between. So the resources available to promote free and open source software are not that many. And I'd like to try and explain some of it through that. Okay, could you do that, please? Yeah, let's go to the next slide. Okay, good. One slide at a time, yes? Okay. Now, we want to try and start by thinking about what can free software do for Africa, and how can Africa benefit from free software? And I think that the answers can be divided into the bullet points that I have on the screen, where you can have better technology, we can have reduced costs, you can have multiple suppliers and sources, there's technology transfer, blah, blah, blah. I think you can read faster than I can speak. So the problem comes in, I want to pose this as a problem because these are benefits, but over my presentation, I'll try and show that these benefits are not, in fact, actually materializing. So the first thing would be, well, better technology, I think, is the only thing that has really come through in a big way. Because with the free software in Africa, it's really driven by the individuals and few corporates or by demand. For example, within the ISP market, you have a lot of free software being used. For example, to send the email, to do the DNS, to do Apache web servers, which I believe is similar to the rest of the world. There's a lot of Linux was, I think, really driven by Apache and the web server market and the explosion of the internet. So you have this coming across in Africa as a demand for internet and web services and websites. And the main agent for the propagation of Linux is actually would be the web developers who are developing websites using things like Apache, PHP, MySQL, and various stuff. But the funny thing is that most of these web developers, even though they're beginning to use free software, they actually use it strictly on the server because they still want some of the Windows applications that are not available on Windows for the web development, such as Dreamweaver, Photoshop, etc. So the typical scenario is that they build things on Windows and then they deploy things on the on Linux. I was one of the very few people who, for a number of years, I refused to use Windows and strictly used Linux, and they all thought I was crazy, you know. And maybe in a way I was, because if you look at the, from a point of view where you can use any piece of software and what you want to do is you want to get a job done instead of being philosophical or stubborn about your use of software, you probably would end up doing a hybrid strategy like was mentioned. So for example, the next benefit of the free software was touched upon by Frederico Heinz and some of the other speakers here, which is the cost reduction. There's a famous study by Richard Bayagosh, who spoke earlier at this conference, called License Fees and GDP Per Capita. And the figures, these figures are taken direct from his study. Ghana's GDP per capita is $269, And if you take Windows and Office, that makes it cost $73,442, which would take you 25 months of your entire GDP per capita. That means you don't eat, you don't drink, use water, you don't need anything else but Windows and Office, and you'll get 25 months before you can do that. South Africa is better because it's the most prosperous country, I believe, on the continent, and that becomes 3 months of GDP per capita. So you think that, you know, free software is a no-brainer because we can save so much money by using free software in Africa. But that is not the case, because as Frederico also mentioned with the unlicensed software case, nobody, because of the absurdly high prices, nobody is paying for this proprietary software. And this is actually increasing the Microsoft market share for software in Africa, because people are exhibiting GPL behavior on proprietary software. So it's spreading. It's spreading and it's taking root and it's becoming advantageous to Microsoft. Now, other software like I've shown, the Dreamweaver, Fireworks, Photoshop, and so on, are also being copied widely. So the effect is that proprietary software is becoming entrenched. And the more entrenched it becomes, the harder it is to persuade people to use free software or have them see the benefits. Because then it becomes a battle on a purely functional basis. Can I do more with free software as a typical end user doing desktop applications than with Windows? And does the cost of switching or changing make it worthwhile for me to relearn and stuff like that? And less than 1% of people pay for this software. So you can see that from this discussion, it becomes clear that proprietary software and free software actually, from the point of view of the end user, they cost the same, which kind of wipes out the biggest benefit of free software for the Africans. You also have multiple suppliers and sources where you would say that, well, you can get Linux from different people, but you can only get Windows or Oracle from one vendor. And you find out that in the commercial world, it's kind of true like that. But in Africa, there's a problem, because the attitude is that technology comes in a box. Technology is something you buy. It's a package. It's a digital camera. It's a camcorder. It's a hi-fi system. It's not a process. It's not something, because there's not very many products created in Africa, because Africa has been struggling with transforming itself from an agricultural system to an industrial system. And because of that, it's hard or it's foreign to visualize technology as something that we're going to build ourselves. And that actually hampers the vision that you can have. We don't have many Linux companies or distributors present inside Africa. Outside of South Africa, the way software is distributed is that they say South Africa is the agent for the software in Africa, and South Africa handles the rest of the continent. So if you look at this multiple suppliers argument and you think about it, somebody would say that, well, in my city, Accra, I can go to shop X, shop Y, shop Z, and buy Windows from here, Windows from there, Windows from there. So I have multiple suppliers, but there's nobody selling Linux. So what do we do now? Now, we talk about technology transfer, which is where perhaps the biggest potential benefit of free software is, where free software can help African developers learn better. We can do more things. We can shortcut the time it takes to become more experienced developers. But we have certain challenges in terms of bandwidth, cost of devices, books, learning materials, and so on. And also, we don't have many African developers available, which is a problem. For example, bandwidth. Bandwidth is very expensive. For $400 a month, you can share 32K pipe with four other people. And for two-thirds of a dollar, you can get an hour of very slow internet access. So we look at DSL prices in the US, and we weep in joy, or is it joy? No, we weep in frustration, where somebody's paying $10 or $15 a month and they get a lot of bandwidth. If you want to buy a computer locally in Africa, people import a computer, they double the price, and that's how they price it to sell. So you have lower salaries, lower incomes, fewer opportunities, yet we have much higher costs, which just makes it worse. The banks don't allow you to have credit cards, so you can't say, well, I'm going to Amazon to buy a book. So for example, I've been in Ghana, I've got a huge wish list on Amazon, but I mean, you just cannot pay for it. There's no payment instrument, and you have to now ship things across the Atlantic, which is a whole different game. Then the poor and disadvantaged youth in Africa then discovered credit card fraud, and then all of a sudden you have an internet center which has got as many seats as here in the room, and 24 hours, 7 days a week, you have the place packed. And after a while, it became obvious that these people were doing credit card fraud on the internet and shopping, etc. So we went to Namibia for an event earlier on this year, and then while we were there, we just found out that the entire sub-region of West Africa has been blacklisted. So when you're trying to buy stuff from West Africa, even if you do have a credit card, they just will not ship it or take your transaction. It's that bad. Okay. Now we have some other problems in the sense that you have a poor educational base. The University of Ghana has 6 PCs for 300 computer science students and 100 PCs for the rest of the students, which is 12,000. And this has a problem where there's basic education before you get to university is very challenging. What they call a 40% literacy rate is inflated because it actually represents basic literacy. So the point is that the pool of developers is severely decimated by the time you get to the university. So if you manage to get through the normal educational system and get to the university, you have few job choices, you don't have big salaries coming out. That's assuming that you learn something in the university. So the result is that the African developer is typically very busy trying to make money. There's no free time. When he gets off his job, he's moonlighting somewhere else trying to make money. So it's nothing to do with community, nothing to do with sharing, and that's what's going to drive it. I think the root cause or the root case to be said from all of here is that it's an African problem that we need economic freedom. Africa only got political freedom. My country, Ghana, was the first country in Africa to be independent in 1957. And just after we got independence, the prices for our primary exports, because we don't determine the prices, started dropping. It went from £2,000 to £800 per ton. We have military coups. Our population is increasing. So the continent just keeps on getting poorer and poorer. Now, why is this continent so poor? Because we have instability, poor governance, disease, famine, but we also have our past to start to talk about, and I'll ask for additional maybe 5 minutes, because it starts from the European discovery of Africa. Because when Europe encountered Africa, the places like Timbuktu had a few institutions of learning, but the problem was that there was a system of divide and conquer, which was used to exert control over an area which was very hostile to white people, because the west coast of Africa, for example, was called the white man's grave, because the sheer number of tropical diseases and so on just decimated the people who came. And what happened is that they'll go to one tribe and say, you know what, these people are your enemies, and we want to work with you and not with them. And then this caused a lot of internal conflict, where some of the worst people, the more cruel kingdoms and tribes, then made war on other people and sent some of their neighbors to become slaves and stuff like that. So Africa lost its best and strongest people, which was a very long time ago, But today, you can see that in America, so the best, the athletes are very fit, very strong, and I believe that's partially from the genetics. And apart from the people, the resources to happen, for example, we have an event called the Partitioning of Africa, which was done in Europe. A group of European countries met and decided how to divide Africa. When I look at Africa, and when you look at the map of Africa and see the countries, that is, those are not the countries of Africa. Those are the divisions in which the European partitionists decided that Africa is going to be shared amongst themselves, and those became the colonies, and those became the countries. A lot of these countries and colonies, former colonies, are actually not viable economies. They wouldn't have existed as countries on their own. But now they all speak different languages, they have different political systems, they have different orientations towards their former colonial masters. And though that is a force that keeps them from collaborating. For example, we have in West Africa the Francophone and Anglophone zone. And when we try and form West African monetary unions, the French secretly move against it because it's going to reduce their influence in Africa, etc. So what happens is that Africa exports its commodities at a very low price because the prices have come down. Then these things come to Europe and America. I used to build finished goods, and then they come back, and then we pay twice the price because one half goes back to Europe, the other half goes to the local merchant who's doubled the markup. And you have poverty, continuous and unalleviated, as a result of that cycle. So I've spoken about some of this on this slide. I think I've skipped this, where I've talked about how the results of the colonial legacy has made Africa have problems. So right now, today, it results in a situation where we have maybe what I described, the 1,000 pieces for 12,000 students, because the government and the schools cannot afford to buy anymore. We have political freedom, we don't have economic freedom, we don't have time to have life, we don't have time to think, we don't have social security, we don't have health insurance, we don't have any safety net in our lives. So you can't have free software in an environment like that, because there's not enough freedom, there's not enough time. And I believe that the has to change from outside, because if Africa is going to get out of its situation, become less dependent and more economically viable, it has to start with something from the West. So what can we do? In the long term, we can distribute wealth and make things fairer. In the medium term, we can support free software, because the forces that have led Africa to where it is are really the forces of greed. They're not the forces of cooperation. They're not the forces of collaboration. They're not in the spirit of free software. Even within the West, you have fights between your progressive forces, which is your Free Software Foundation, the Creative Commons, and your conservative and regressive forces, which are, for example, your film industries, etc. It's the same industries that you're fighting against. Those are the same sorts of industries that we need to fight against. And I think that if free software and that those forces win, there's a much better chance for the rest of the work to be done. In the short term, we need to build a developer community. We can only do it one developer at a time, because there's so few of them, they're so hard to find. And there's another man in the audience here, Gert Loving, who we've corresponded before. We were talking about forming something called Programmers Without Frontiers. And if we could start something where we could use the communities outside, we could use the strength of the free software community, which is the people outside, to help build the missing part of free software in Africa, which is the African community itself. And Programmers Without Frontiers is something that could help. There's also a separate organization that I want to build within Africa itself. It's called African Intelligence, where we want to find the developers one by one. we want to improve their quality of life by letting them focus on developing, and the organization or other people focus on getting the projects and getting the work so that they can actually buy their own PCs. We don't need to think too much, you know, send them cheap, old, refurbished PCs. We want to think more in terms of that. Let them make some money for themselves. Let them be able to afford PCs and or to spend the money however they want to. Well, we haven't gone very far yet, but we have our logo and our vision, which is called African Intelligence, where we just want to think of it as, you know, it's a light bulb with Africa on the back and so on. But things can change very fast. I believe I've painted a very bleak picture, but I like to say it took 40 to 50 years for the use of fixed line telephones in Nigeria to get to 500,000 users. It took about 20 years for the use of to have 500,000 TV sets inside Nigeria, but it took 3 months for Nigeria to get 500,000 GSM mobile phones. So at the right price point, with the right technology and the right direction, things can change very fast. Thank you very much.